You are a hero to thousands of pilots all over the world. So my question to you is, who are your heroes? Who do you really look up to?
Well, again, I've been the luckiest and most privileged person in the world to meet the people from the early days of aviation up to the present. At Wright Field, I was assigned to fly the first jets we had, and the colonel running the division said, "We've got a special guest coming here today, and we want you to demonstrate the P-80 for him." And it was Mr. Orville Wright. And I shook hands with him, and I was so flabbergasted I could hardly talk to him. But I met the great man himself. I didn't get to know him, but I felt so privileged just to be able to say that I had met him. Then, a little bit later, General Doolittle watched me perform with the jet, and that's when he made this remark that you read earlier. And he was my idol when I was growing up. I'd read about him and all of his many accomplishments. And as all of you know, he got the Medal of Honor for the raid on Tokyo. And he was just the most marvelous individual you could ever meet. He was so humble, and here he was at that time, a three-star general. And he asked me after I finished flying, there was a colonel standing there with us, and he said to this colonel, "Could I use your office for a few minutes? I'd like a little privacy." And he said, "Of course, sir." And so we went over to his office, just the two of us, and he said, "Son, I've never seen any flying like that in my life." And he said, "I want you to know from now on, if we're alone, I know protocol won't permit, but if we're just the two of us, I will always be just Jimmy Doolittle to you." And I said, "Oh boy, I can't believe this." Well, it was the beginning of a lifelong relationship. Colleen and I were invited to his anniversary parties, his birthday parties every year, and he really had some big bashes, I'll tell you. He was a hero like none other. And the Chinese anywhere in the world thought that he walked on the clouds. I've got to tell you, he was just a great individual. Well, Lindbergh, it had been an inspiration of mine. Never heard, never seen him, met him, never anticipated I would ever get to meet him. And I was demonstrating a new fighter over in Germany after War II, and there were people crowded around when I finished the flight, and this old gentleman came up, old to me, and he had on a felt hat, and he had on a suit from back in the late 20s where he had a belt across the back, and he said, "I'd like to talk to you privately." Well, I didn't know who he was, and I just said, "Well, sir, I wish to talk to you, and I would like to, but can you wait?" I said, "I can't just turn my back on all these people who want to shake hands and get their pictures taken." And he said, "I understand." And so after 30 or 40 minutes, I looked over, and he's still standing there. And so I went over to him, and he said, "I'm Charles Lindbergh." And I said, "Oh, boy." My mouth hung open. I couldn't believe it. I finally met the man that was my superhero. Well, he was under an assumed name, and he was a member of the board of directors of the Pan American Airlines, and he told me that he had been in obscurity for so long and lost out on all the technologies that were taking place between the time he disappeared from the public eye until then. And he said, "I don't ever wish to be recognized again. But," he said, "I want to be brought up to date." And he said, "What flight are you going home on?" And I told him, and it was Pan Am. And it was in the days of the old Boeing Clippers and prop airplanes. So it was 9 hours. And he said, "I'll have our seats reserved." And in the next 9 hours, we had the greatest time in the world. Swapping stories, and he was asking me about all the latest in technology. We were into the rocket business, which he had tried to be in with Dr. Goddard back in the early 30s. And he wanted to soak up knowledge. And he said, I still have a secret clearance, and I'd like to come visit you in Los Angeles, always under the assumed name, and have you set up briefings with the technical people within your company so I can get up to date on rocketry and all of the space activities. And so I told him that I would do everything I could to make it happen. So when I returned from the trip, I went in to see Dutch Kellenberg and Lee Atwood, the founders of North American Aviation. They were the two who designed the DC-2 and DC-3 for Donald Douglas, and then broke away and started that company, as so many other people did, like Larry Bell of Bell Aircraft. That's where he got his initial training in design work. Well, it turned out that they told me, I told him a story, and he wanted utter secrecy, complete secrecy, and not have anyone know who he was. And I said, I told him I wanted him to meet you two, and he said, I don't want to meet anybody if they know who I am. And so Lee and Dutch told me, you make sure he's got that security clearance, and then we'll close our eyes to everything else. Well, I did, and I had our security people check over what he had, and they confirmed, yes, he did have it. And I brought him in there, and I had all kinds of scientific people briefing him and bringing him up to date. And boy, he could absorb it like a sponge. And we became very close friends. About every 6 weeks he'd come, and I'd have another battery of people. He'd spend a whole day just soaking up information, and I'd stay with him and make sure he had the right people. And if he asked questions they couldn't answer, I knew who to go to. And it was an enormous experience for me. And then finally, he had heard about the Society of Experimental Test Pilots. And I told him, I said, they would really like very much to have you as an honorary member, but the only way you can become one is appear in person to receive the award. And he said, well, I want to do it, but I don't want to be come out of obscurity. And I said, well, that's the only way you can do it. And so this went on, and he brought it up again a couple of times. And I was the president of the organization. And Wallace Schirra, one of the original astronauts, was also my vice president on the board of directors for the Society of Experimental Test Pilots. So Wally wrote him a letter, and he said, I want you to know that we would be privileged to have you receive this honorary award from us. And if you don't accept this time, you'll never get another opportunity. It was pretty strong words that went on, but he called me up and said, I got this letter. And I said, well, he just called it like it is. And I said, it'd be the greatest thing in the world to have you come out of obscurity. And he said, well, could you bring me in the back door? Nobody would know who I was. I said, by this time I'm calling him Slim. I said, Slim, it wouldn't matter. People don't know what you look like. It's been so long. And he said, but I don't want to be hounded. I don't want my picture taken. And I don't want to have to sign autographs. I won't. He said, if you can't protect me, I can't do it. And I said, okay. I said, but you're missing a great opportunity. Well, I then learned that Neil Armstrong and the Apollo 11 crew were going to be out of quarantine the day before our big banquet night, honors night. And I called Deke, and I said, Deke, here's the situation. I believe I could get him to capitulate on the way he thinks about the organization if I could tell him that I had the Apollo 11 crew here, and I will give them an award as well. And he said, Hoover, he said, you know how to draw on a friendship, don't you? And I said, I think this would be great for our country. It'd be great for NASA. And I said, to anyone in the aviation world, wouldn't it be magnificent to have Charles Lindbergh and Neil Armstrong there at the same time? And he said, all right, you win. He was saying, they got to get with their families and everything. I said, you call somebody at the White House, and they'll send Air Force One down there to Houston to pick him up. And they were getting out of quarantine the day before, so they wouldn't have a chance to go home or anything. I said, take the families with them. And so he said, boy, he said, you sure want this to happen? And I said, I think it would be magnificent. Well, then I turned around to Slim and I said, I got to going to have the Apollo 11 crew there, and I don't think anybody had ever, he said, he wanted this obscurity. I said, look, you walk in the front door in your tux, and you'll just be another person wearing a tux. No one will recognize you. They won't know who you are. They're going to be here to see the Apollo 11 crew for the first time. And so he said, you really believe that? I said, yes, I'll just be standing inside the door. And so he came through the door. Nobody knew who he was, just like I told him. And he said, where are you taking me? And I said, I'm going to take you up to my suite. I said, I've got the presidential suite, and I have some close friends of mine, Bob and Dolores Hope, and I had Conrad and Baron Hilton and a lot of notable people in my suite for cocktails before we went down to the banquet. And I said, that's where, he said, I'm not going. And I said, well, what do you want to do? And he said, I want to go to your room and I want to read you what I'm going to say. And I said, all right. So my bedroom was right off the suite. And so I went in there and I sat there just about as nervous as you can be, worrying about all the events that were happening that night that I would be responsible for. And all a room full of celebrity people right on the other side of the door. And I sat there and listened to the most boring speech you've ever heard in your life. It was on conservation. And when he got through, he said, well, what do you think? I said, oh, it was just great. It was magnificent. Lousiest thing I ever heard. When he got on stage, no one cared what he had to say. It was just his presence. But he sat there. He went down with Neil and my wife, Colleen. And she was seated between Lindbergh and Neil, and I was next to Neil. And they got a photograph with the Associated Press, and it hit the front pages of newspapers all over the world. And it was just a magical thing to have two people of such magnificence in the way of accomplishments to be together. And it was a happy night for him, and he wrote me a letter that I couldn't repeat it because it was very, very complimentary. But at the end of the letter, he said, by the way, I don't know really where I am. He said, I'm in Hong Kong, and it given my reservations for accommodations to somebody else, and I had no place to stay. And this very nice lady invited me to stay at her house. And he said, I've got the door locked, but I think I might be in a house of ill repute.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, I got the letter, and a few years later, after his death, I received the Lindbergh Award at the Smithsonian, and there must have been 1,800 people there. And I asked Ann Maher, who was there to make the presentation to me, and his daughter, one of his daughters, and I said, would you accept if Wally read this letter, because he told me how important it was for him to finally break the ice and gather all this knowledge that he had been accepting. And they both thought it would be amusing because of his comment there about the House of Ill Repute. And so Wally read it, and it was a great evening for everybody. But that's my Lindbergh story.